Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. The National Maritime College of Ireland has signed a major contract with Chevron Shipping. Author of Sea Spray and Whiskey, Norman Freeman, on an amorous ship's captain. Later in this week's edition of Seascapes, we'll hear from author, historian and founder of the Titanic Trail in Cove, Michael Martin, on a new book he's just written on the Lusitania, the sinking of which by torpedo by a German U-boat off the old head of Kinsale 99 years ago was marked in the past week. Niamh Riley attended the commemorations in Cove last Monday as the people of the town remembered the fate of those lost at sea from the Lusitania.
Today in Cove, they will, for example, assemble in the old church cemetery where many of the victims were eventually interred. And they'll have a ceremony there to mark the loss of those people. In town then, by the beautiful Lusitania Peace Memorial, wreaths will be laid, not just by dignitaries and political figures, but also by fishermen and by a local person, making that link with the fishermen from Cove who undertook many, many journeys out and back to the sinking of the wreck to try and save as many people as possible.
So many of the bodies here in a mass grave, and they come from all over the world to see where their family are actually laid to rest.
Everywhere you look, every headstone has a story to tell.
I'm here with Jack Gilmartin, a local historian in the old cemetery Cove, where many of the bodies from the Lusitania were buried.
Now, in the cemetery here, there were 173 burials. It is now 169. We had four people who are reinterred, Abercrombie and Watson and Bessie O'Hare, who was a nanny in America. She was reburied again in Tuam, County Galway. Here you have 26 individual graves. You have three communal graves. You have the first one there, which is 69 bodies, but 67 coffins. What they did at the time, if a little baby had been found and not identified, that was put in with an adult. That was 69 there. Generally, Church of Ireland people, Church of England, the Protestant people, if you like, to put it that way. And in the second one here then, what you have is religion unknown and non-Christian. Now, we have identified some of them there over the years, and we know now that some are Church of England, we know some are Roman Catholics, etc., and similarly in the first communal grave I spoke about. And the third one then, you have the Roman Catholic one, Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox church people buried in it. There's 27 there altogether. So you have a total of 169. The final burial here was of a little boy, Scott Weatherby Jr., whose body was not found until the 16th of June. This terrible tragedy happened on the 7th of May. He's buried there. He was a four-year-old boy. His father then died in the 1920s, was cremated in the United States and brought over here and buried with his son. Now, we still get people coming here, descendants of the victims here, still coming over here every year practically to remember their forebears, you know, who suffered so tragically. Those who were saved did suffer trauma afterwards, I should say, and even those who dealt with the bodies when they came back here into Cove, into Queenstown as it was then.
From land and sea. John Hennessy, another local historian, is here to tell us about Cove's connection with the ill-fated liner.
She meant to take a bairn from the old hen, and she had varied her course back in a bit, and of course she came in line of the submarine who was inside, and they just let go, and there was only one torpedo that actually hit her, and she sank within 18 minutes. Now the local connections then, like that would have went to the rescue. We had actually a lifeboat station here back then. There was a lifeboat station here in, as it was then, Queenstown. On that particular day, there was no real weather there. The lifeboats back then depended on wind, because they had a sail, and if there wasn't sailing, they'd have to roar the distance wherever they had to go. There was 10 in the lifeboat, and they had big long oars for to pull that boat, like, you know, because she was 34 feet long. But the boat that actually towed the Queenstown boat that day to the scene of the tragedy of Lusitania was a fishing trawler that the Navy had back then, the Royal Navy. There was a second lifeboat went to the scene as well. That was the Cork McSherry boat, West Cork. And the Cork McSherry men had to row the full distance. They had the aid of no tow. So, I mean, if the Cork McSherry men had the same aid as the Cove boat had on that particular day, they would have been on the scene earlier. But both boats arrived at the same time.
That report from Niamh Riley for Seascapes, we heard also the voices of Claire Cullinan and John Mulville. Carrick Craft and Waveline Cruisers will be merging for the 2015 boat hire season. The combined fleet of 125 boats will be based at Carrick Craft's existing marinas at Carrick-on-Shannon and Banagher-on-the-Shannon and at Ballinalech on Lough Erne. Administration and accounting will be centralised at Carrick Craft's Market Hill office. You can read more on the Seascapes webpage. Calves Week in West Cork was launched this week, and we'll be speaking to Commodore Tygo Dwyer about the event and hearing about the Skull Regatta, which is celebrating its 130th anniversary this year. You can hear more on Seascapes next Friday. Next to this tale from writer and broadcaster Norman Freeman.
Every seafarer can tell stories about captains. They are such a dominant element in seafaring. They have many responsibilities. The captain's personality and his moods can set the tone of the ship for better or for worse. Of the captains I sailed under, there is one particular man I remember with affection. He was a small, squat man with broad shoulders. He had a shiny, bald head. His wide, elastic mouth smiled easily and opened often in laughter. His name was Leonard Bunn, and he was the captain of our ship, the Aranda. She was a deck passenger ship that plied between Karachi on the upper edge of the Arabian Sea and Chittagong at the top of the Bay of Bengal on the other side of the Indian subcontinent. Lenny, as we called him, carried his responsibilities calmly. He was a good judge of character. He knew how to get the best out of people, to handle those under his command. He would say things like, "I know you'll deal with that with your usual efficiency. Your navigational skills are first rate, second officer." His policy was to let people get on with their jobs, to show them trust. Words of praise and a smile were second nature to him. He spoke some Hindi and some Urdu, and often stopped to speak with members of our crew. Our ship was a happy one. When we were in Karachi, the agents, McKinnon and McKenzie, sometimes took parties of valued shippers and influential dignitaries on board for a gala night. The promenade deck was festooned with lights and bunting. a Goan band played. Captain Bunn used to ask some of us to help act as hosts, chatting to guests, making sure their glasses were filled, and taking some of the women out to dance. But when the party was over and the guests had stumbled down the gangway, he would say, "Now that we've got rid of that shower, let's have a drink," and invite us up to his spacious cabin. He loved to sing song and always came forward to sing his favourite, "It's a Singing to Tell a Lie," in a baritone voice. There was a memorable incident in Karachi. Some of us had gone to dinner in one of the big hotels there and spotted him sitting at a table with some people from the shipping agency. He saw us and came over to us. He grinned. "I'm stuck with this crowd, but at least there's some sort of a floor show." Sometime afterwards, there was a roll of drums from the four-piece band and it began to play Arabic-sounding music. A girl clad in filmy veils came onto the dance floor. She glided about sinuously, her limbs and arms moving about suggestively. Then she paused and looked about the dinner tables, seeking someone on whom to demonstrate her seductive ritual. This was for to be the amusement of all the diners except for the male victim of her choice. Apparently, she usually singled out some middle-aged or elderly man. Lenny's bald head must have caught her attention. She swayed over to him. Without actually touching him, she weaved her hands and arms around his face. There was an uneasy titter from the dancers. But she had picked on the wrong man. Lenny sprang to his feet, grabbed her round the bare waist, and began to waltz around the dance floor. The diners were convulsed with laughter. The band switched to the Blue Danube Waltz. We stood up at our table and clapped loudly. Eventually, Lenny gave her a peck on the cheek and let her go. He took a bow to a huge cheer. Later, as we were leaving, a stout Pakistani businessman asked us, "Who is that jolly fellow that is waltzing the girl around the floor?" "That's our captain," we answered proudly.
Norman Freeman and the Amorous Captain. I see that Lorna Siggins is reporting in the Irish Times that a 4,500-year-old log boat is among 12 early Bronze Age, Iron Age and medieval craft that have been located in Loch Corrib, along with several Viking-style battle axes and other weapons. The vessels were discovered by marine surveyor Captain Trevor Northage while mapping the Western Lake to update the British Admiralty charts. You can read more on the Seascapes webpage. We had planned to mark the passing of the remarkable Daphne Poachin Mould on this edition of Seascapes. However, we will do so on next week's programme. Brandon Bay has always delivered wind and waves at this time of the year, and with beaches facing most directions, 2014 is sure to be no exception. The BWA Ireland Wave Sailing Championships will take place in Kerry from the 12th to the 16th of May, and the Irish Windsurfing Association members will become honorary members at no extra cost. More information on www.irelandbwa.co.uk. That's www.irelandbwa.co.uk. Out of Arklow by Danny O'Neill has just been published. Danny shipped out of Arklow as a boy of 13 on local fishing boats, going on to join the Merchant Navy, working his way from ordinary seaman to master. He served on 80 different boats and ships and was master of 37 of them. They included fishing vessels, coasters, tramp steamers, cattle boats, passenger ships, tankers, container ships, dredgers, yachts and patrol boats. His book, Out of Arklow, A Life of Change, is published by Author House and is being launched next Friday in the Maritime Museum in Arklow. We wish you fair sailing and congratulations, Danny. As we mentioned earlier, the past week saw ceremonies to mark the 99th anniversary of the loss of the Lusitania and much coverage of the controversy regarding access to the vessel. Author and historian Michael Martin has just completed a book on the vessel, which is due for publication in October. He spoke exclusively to Seascapes about some new discoveries relating to the vessel.
The book is entitled RMS Lusitania, It Wasn't and It Didn't. And the subtitle refers to the fact that there is a general perception, among the public at least, the ordinary public, that there is some question about the presence of munitions on board the Lusitania. Whereas in actual fact, there is no question that she wasn't carrying large quantities of munitions. Another element, I think, of the misconception of the general public is that the sinking of the ship brought America into the war immediately or soon after. And neither of those suppositions are correct, as it turns out. The ship was carrying munitions, which begs the question, was it an innocent vessel? No, it wasn't. Were the passengers on board innocent? Yes, they were. And account has to be taken of that. But she would have, by any manner of means, in wartime, she would have been a legitimate target for another belligerent. She had large quantities of 303 rounds on it. She had quantities of shrapnel shells, which were effectively 3-inch shells, that were packed with lead pellets. And these were designed in particular to explode over trenches and mete out whatever damage they could mete out. So those munitions were on board. They're on the manifest for the Lusitania. And despite all of that, a kind of a narrative was created over the years, in my view. Now, I'm not referring to historians or people who are well-read, military historians and scholars, but there was a narrative, in my view, created that has managed to stay there for almost a century, whereby people think that this was an out-of-the-blue savage attack on an innocent vessel that brought America into the war. And as my book title states, it wasn't and it didn't. In fact, America didn't join the war for a full 2 years later. One of the arguments that arose later on was about the legality or not of carrying munitions. And the Passenger Acts of the United States in 1882, which were amended on several occasions between then and the First World War, but basically what they said was that nothing can be carried on a passenger ship that in itself can explode and cause a danger. Now, with a stretch, you could say that 303 round with the gunpowder enclosed in a case wasn't in itself explosive. So you could say you're complying with the regulations. And similarly, for the 3-inch or 3.5-inch shells that were in use at the time, if the incendiary fuses were out of them and not in use, they could be said to be fairly stable. So there was an argument, at least, that while they may have been complying with the legality of the act, that the spirit of it was not being complied with. And in the overall sense, whether they were explodable or not on their own and in their own right, they were being brought to Great Britain for use on the green fields of France and elsewhere against German military soldiers. So in that sense, they were a legitimate target. We technically still haven't got a definitive answer as to what exploded. There's another theory. Paddy O'Sullivan of Bandon, who's written a book on the subject, contended that it was aluminium shavings that were in, I think it was 92 barrels of it on board. And he showed in small sort of garage experiments that if aluminium shavings are sent into a dust cloud formation, that they can explode and be quite explosive. Others argue that the shavings at that time weren't small enough for that to happen. So we still don't know. One of the interesting points made by one author was that the reason that they diverted passengers into Cove, or Queenstown as it was then, from Kinsale, because that was an action they took very, very early. The Admiralty ordered at one point that all survivors and bodies be brought to Queenstown. One author concluded from that they feared that there would be evidence from the shrapnel shell or other forms of ammunition on bodies that they had died from explosions. There certainly isn't any doubt that there were munitions on board. What caused the explosion, I make the point in my book, doesn't really matter, because they were carrying something, obviously, that was explosive. The initial explosion that was caused by the torpedo didn't... The second explosion wasn't from the torpedo. They were, you know, fairly basic torpedoes, although formidable looking, 18 to 22 feet long. But they had a certain amount of explosives in them, and that explosion took place. It was the second explosion that came that we still don't know about. But the point I've made in the book is that it doesn't matter whether the second explosion was aluminium shavings or whether it was munitions per se or gun cotton powders, or gun cotton, as one author claims as well. It doesn't really matter. They were not complying with the regulations of the US where they took on these things at the time. And Cunard, in that sense, has to be taken to task, or should have been taken to task, about what they were carrying. In the narrative that followed the sinking of the ship, all blame was put onto the shoulders of the German submarine commander and the German Navy at the time. I think nowadays, if a passenger vessel essentially was carrying munitions, the owners would be accused of using those passengers as human shields. You know, that's sort of language that we'd use today. One of the things that I've concentrated on in the book was the movements of a ship called HMS Juno. What's written about the Lusitania is how little HMS Juno is mentioned. HMS Juno was a vessel that was part of a squadron that was tasked with patrolling the approaches to the Bristol Channel and the South Irish Sea. She'd been built in 1897 or thereabouts, and she was armed with 11 six-inch guns, formidable weapons in their own right. And they were there because of the submarine threat. They were there to assist merchant shipping, the approaches, the western approaches and so on. And in what was a routine return to Cork Harbour on the day Lusitania was torpedoed, HMS Juno comes into the harbour, ties up to the buoy, and at the very time she was tying up to the buoy, the Lusitania is struck, and in 18 minutes she's completely disappeared and there are hundreds of people in the water. As one would expect, the ship very soon after uncoupled itself from the mooring, the buoy, makes her way out of Cork Harbour, and was 10 minutes past Roach's Point on her way to the scene of the sinking when she turned 180 degrees and came back and tied up to the buoy. The logbook for the day suggests that they wrote in tied up to buoy number 2 as requested. So I've set a few questions in my forthcoming book, in which I ask, why did HMS Juno put to sea? She didn't go out there on a skiing expedition. She didn't go out there because she wanted to go out. She had come in for a specific reason. One has to assume, and this was admitted later, that she was sent to render aid to the sinking Lusitania. Remember, there were people literally in the water. The ship was gone. Other vessels, smaller vessels, with heroic fishermen and local people were making their way out despite the danger posed by a submarine that might be lingering around. They made their way out there. And HMS Juno makes her way out too. The captain and the crew didn't object. They were on their way. And 10 minutes past Roach's Point, they turn around and come back. Now, the sort of official spin on that over the years has been, well, it was a decision, humanitarian as it was, to go out and help them. A more practical decision was made not to stand this ship into danger. It was old and almost obsolete and would have been a sitting duck for the submarine. But I don't kind of buy that too much. The ship itself had been doing 17 knots that morning. The submarine was only capable of 8 or 9 submerged. So speed wasn't an issue.
Surely the armaments weren't an issue. She had 11 6-inch guns, while there were trawlers and fishing boats out there with no protection whatsoever. And the willingness of the crew wasn't in question. So the ship was ordered back. And I've asked why. The circumstances for which she was deployed were still there. Captain Turner, for example, was still in the water at that stage, as were many others. People were drowning at that stage. So the biggest surprise to me in my research is about how little attention has been given to the movements of HMS Juno. And I'm hoping that my book will explore some of that.
Michael Martin's book on the Lusitania will be published in October. GAC Training and Service Solutions, GTSS, a joint venture between the National Maritime College of Ireland and global shipping, logistics and marine service provider GAC, have been awarded a 4-year training contract with Chevron Shipping Company. It's the single largest maritime training contract in the history of the Irish state. We hope to speak to Conor Moles of NMCI in the coming weeks about what's involved. Next week here on Seascapes, the remarkable Daphne Pochin Mould is remembered. We hear about Calves Week and the Skull Regatta, which celebrates its 130th anniversary, the Baltimore Wooden Boat Festival, and Kieran Devaney takes us aboard Radio Caroline, and we'll have details of the Ocean to City Maritime Festival. All that and much more here on your maritime programme. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.